You might turn to Matthew chapter 11. We're going to look at some things from Matthew chapter 11 in just a moment or two. I started in on the reading program. I think it was the first day of the year. And I kind of got behind, but I was catching up. And so one afternoon I was reading Matthew chapter 10 through 12. And I noticed in chapter 11 some things about John. I thought, you know, I had some things in there I think that would make a pretty good study. So tonight we're going to look at some of the things that I noticed in here in verses 1 through 19. And then thoughts that developed. Now, in the very beginning of this, and we'll read those passages in a moment or two, but what a person needs to do, this is kind of relative to verse 1, but John was a man that was sent from God, it says in John chapter 1 and verse 6. And that's a fact that, of course, well, because of the way it's said, how it's said, it's indisputable. And John is someone... My son-in-law and I were talking about this, that John is a forerunner. It was necessary that he do some things that hadn't been done before. And some of those things might be kind of difficult things to do. And maybe we don't, you know, fully appreciate it as much as we should. I told him that I was thinking about this, and I was thinking about a character in American history. A sports figure now, but bear with me a moment. I thought about all of the sports figures, and boy, I'm telling you, after watching that game last night, oh, prima donnas seem to fit the picture. You know, you've got these fellas in sports, and it doesn't matter who they are. But suddenly, they're just it, you know, and oh my, and to hear them go on and whine and complain about playing conditions and what they're paid and how people don't respect them, etc., etc., etc. And I thought to myself, oh my goodness. I thought, could any of them, any one of them, do something like what Jackie Robinson did? Now you think about it. He's a forerunner. And I've long been have interest in him. For different reasons. But I've read four or five books, biographies on Jackie Robinson. And they're going to be showing a biography here in a little while. I've watched that movie that they made a few years ago, and I've seen numbers of things on him. And I don't think that we really get the full impact of what it was like for him to be a forerunner in that. The abuse that he took, you know, just the seeming, and it just seemed like it would never end. And that went, and I mean, it was just, this wasn't something that built up. It was like this from day one. And then, I don't know, I just think it, my whole thing is, I think it takes an exceptional person to do something like that. And I've always wondered why Branch Rickey picked him. And I've never been able to find out why. You know, some definitive reason as to why him, out of all of the hundreds of others. But he was the right man. John the Baptist was the right man. And you think about the things that John the Baptist, you know, John the Baptist endured some ridicule, that man out there in the wilderness, you know, and all that. And then he was arrested by Herod. For no good reason. He endured a lot of things too, but he was a forerunner. And forerunners, of necessity, often, have kind of a tough way to go when they're, you know, blazing the trail, so to speak. And I thought about that with John, and Sean and I were talking about that just a little bit. We had, you know, others that were like that as well. The text that you find here in Matthew chapter 11, verses 1 through 19, is also found in Luke chapter 7, verses 18 and 35. It's very similar over there. We'll probably look at a couple things over there, but not spend a whole lot of time because it's just nearly identical to what you have over here. But we start with verse 1. It came to pass when Jesus finished commanding his 12 disciples that he departed from there to teach and to preach in their cities. And when John had heard in prison about the works of Christ, he sent two of his disciples and said to him, "Are you the coming one, or do we look for another?" Jesus answered and said to them, "Go and tell John the things which you hear and see. The blind see and the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised up, and the poor have the gospel preached to them. And blessed is he who is not offended because of me." As they departed, Jesus began to say to the multitudes concerning John, "What did you go out into the wilderness to see? A reed shaken by the wind? But what did you go out to see? A man clothed in soft garments? Indeed, those who wear soft clothing are in king's houses. But what did you go out to see? A prophet. Yes, I say to you, and more than a prophet. For this is he of whom it is written, 'Behold, I send my messenger before your face, who will prepare your way before you.' Assuredly, I say to you, among those born of women, there has not risen one greater than John the Baptist. And he who is least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he. And the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom of heaven suffers violence, and the violent take it by force. For all the prophets and the law prophesied until John, and if you are willing to receive it, he is Elijah who is to come. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. But to what shall I liken this generation? It is like children sitting in the marketplace and calling to their companions and saying, 'We played the flute for you, and you did not dance. We mourned to you, and you did not lament.' For John came neither eating nor drinking, and they say, 'He has a demon.' The Son of Man came eating and drinking, and they say, 'Look, a glutton and a winebibber, a friend of tax collectors and sinners.' But wisdom is justified by her works." Your translation might have children there, but that's a mistranslation. The word that's translated there is translated every other place in the New Testament as either deeds or works. And so that's really what it means there. But I guess children being the product of what's being done works in that sense, I suppose. Have a literary sense. But now verse 1 is kind of connective to the last chapter, the previous chapter. The 12 had been given their instructions and they'd been sent forth. And what you have is Jesus is still in Galilee. He would be all in the region of Galilee. He spent most of his time in about the middle of the Sea of Galilee up to the northwest corner in that particular area. But he continues the teaching and preaching on his own here. Now, John the Baptist, when you get over to verses 2 and 4, he's in prison, of course, and we're told that. That's mentioned actually back in Matthew chapter 4, verse 12. There's a very strong tradition that has it that Herod imprisoned John in his fortress, kind of the family fortress, if you will, which was on the east side of the Dead Sea, across from Jerusalem, more or less. That was the area of the Hasmoneans. The Herods were of Hasmonean descent. They were actually not Jews by blood, but they were Jews by marriage. My comment about Herod, I'm not a big fan of the Herods in any way, shape, or form. I don't mean this derogatorily, but Herod was about as much Jewish as a donkey. You know, he just wasn't anything about it. And so it would make sense in this traditional idea that they would have him captured over there. Thus, he would be away from his Jewish brethren over there, John would be, and be under wraps by people who would be loyal to Herod. So John was, if that's true, John's kind of out of the way. He's not getting a whole lot of information. He can't see what's going on, and he's not hearing a whole lot about what's going on. Maybe hearing some things, but maybe not as much as he would like to be hearing. Now, John is said to have remained there until such time that Herod had him put to death. So, John's disciples, if you, now this is what we want to do. We want to hold your finger there, but go over to Luke chapter 7. Luke chapter 7, verse 18. It appears as though John had some visitors because it says in verse 18, the disciples of John reported to him concerning all these things. So he did receive some information. And that prompts what takes place next, which you can see in verse 19. We'll take a look at that. Two of the disciples, he sent them to Jesus saying, are you the coming one or do we look for another? Which is the same thing as you find back over there in Matthew. But now, here's the thing about this. This inquiry, you know, John's inquiry, after all, he sends them with this question. And this has actually confounded many for centuries as to, you know, what this indicates. And there are some kind of unique ideas about it. There's some that I think make some sense. And there's a couple of them, I think, that are probable, if you will. First of all, you ask yourself now, when they went over there with that question or questions, was that to bolster John's faith? After all, he's been kind of out of the loop. He doesn't know what's going on. There's a good chance he doesn't know if Jesus is preaching or dead or in prison himself and so on. So, you know, what's going on? And, you know, if someone's isolated like John in the situation he is, you can understand how maybe just a little bit of information, a little bit of news might perk somebody up. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that John is in danger of losing his faith here. A little reassurance, you know, sometimes is a good thing. And we get reassurance quite often. You know, your parents, for example, or a spouse will on occasion tell you how they love you. It doesn't mean that they stop loving you. But those are words that reassure us. Same way with children and so on. So some reassurance isn't necessarily a bad thing. So that would be not necessarily to bolster John's faith, because I don't think that was necessary. After all, John did know of Jesus. Now you can go over to John chapter 1. Verses 19 through 37, I'm not going to read that. It's kind of a lengthy reading. But it's the time that centers around the baptism of Jesus. And it's got some facts about what took place before and after and so on. And you know, you be careful as you read that to try and put it together, all the information that's in there, you know, chronologically. But one thing is for sure, John said that, how he knew this, I'm not sure, but he said, the one that I saw the Holy Spirit descending on, that was him. Now, he knew that. There was a sign there for that. And then, after all this, when John's with other people, he sees Jesus in the crowd, and he says, behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. Now, John knew perfectly who Jesus was. He knew that he was the one that he was the forerunner for. The voice of one in the wilderness crying, prepare the way of the Lord. This was the Lord. Now, John knew all that. But now he wonders what's going on. What's the state of things? And so on. And a little reassuring. Well, that, you know, given his situation, you know, that might be a good thing. But now here's the other thing that, again, is a possibility. And that is that the questions that John sent his disciples with, were they for the benefit of his disciples? Now, that's possible, too. And that's very, very probable as well. Now, but here's the thing, you see. There's this transition going on. And John has disciples. It says that they're his disciples. Two of his disciples in verse 2. Sends them over there. But now, John's disciples must not remain devoted to and following John. After all, John said something himself along this line when he said,
in John chapter 3 and verse 30 that he, Jesus, must increase, but I, John, must decrease. As a matter of fact, John was going to die before Jesus. And so his disciples, there's going to come a point where they should no longer follow John. What they should do is follow the one that John was foretelling about. And that, of course, would be Jesus Christ. So that's probable too. Now, you can look at this and you can decide one makes sense or the other makes sense and go with that. And maybe even it's perhaps a little bit of both in it, are equally true and probable. Whatever the case is, the person will have to make up their mind for themselves. But now, I want us to notice something very carefully. Jesus tells them to go back and to report to John. And in verse 4, he says, "You go and tell John the things which you see and hear," or "you hear and see," however it's worded in the translation. Some have a different order there. It doesn't change anything. But now, the emphasis right here is on what you see and hear. Now, not what others tell you, or not what you hear others say. You go back and tell John what you have been eyewitnesses and ear witnesses to. That's what you should do. And then that goes right in to what you see in verses 5 and 6, which we're going to look at now. Verses 5 and 6, you find there that this is what's going on. Now the blind and the see, the lame are walk, the lepers are cleansed, and so on. Luke chapter 7, verse 21, has that in there. It says, "He cured many of infirmities, afflictions, evil spirits, and to many he gave sight." And you go back there in verse 22, and that's what you tell Jesus. You tell him that that's what you've seen and heard. Now we know that prior to Matthew chapter 11, Jesus has done some of these very things. Restore the sight to the blind, and the lame have been made to all these things. But now, there's one thing in here that's kind of particular. We'll look at that in just a minute. I want to back up here. Let me get over here, get that caught up. Actually, there's something about this back in Isaiah chapter 35, verses 5 and 6. Isaiah 35, verses 5 and 6. "The eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped. Then the lame shall leap like a deer, and the tongue of the dumb sing. The waters shall burst forth in the wilderness, and streams in the desert." And all these things are coming. There's going to be a highway of holiness later on, verse 8. And so on, and you find out that this is, the great day of the Lord that's coming, and that's with the coming of the Lord. And so they're seeing all these things that have been prophesied in there, but he also says that the poor have the gospel preached to them. I think that's something that's important, very important. Because in that day, the poor might not necessarily have the gospel preached to them. Now, of course, there's his message that's important. No matter who is in the audience, the message is the important thing. We can read something like over in John chapter 7, verse 46, where there was the pronouncement about him that never has any man spoken like this man. All right, that's about his message, isn't it? But it wasn't just the message that they're, here. But the remarkable thing about the audience, that's the thing. The poor might be often overlooked, but Jesus didn't do this. And we find out that that's another case of a prophecy. When he was in Nazareth and had occasion in Luke chapter 4 and had occasion to speak in the synagogue, he was offered the scroll. He read from it. And what he read was actually from Isaiah chapter 61. And he said, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me. He's anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor, sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord." And then when they waited for him to comment on this, he said, "Today this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing." In other words, you heard me read these things. You know it's a prophecy about someone. And it's about the one that you just heard read these things. They wouldn't miss that point. Sometimes we might miss it, but they wouldn't miss that. But again, here, it's to preach the gospel to the poor. And so, you know, Jesus didn't overlook this. And we can understand that there's the passage that says the common people heard him gladly. And that actually means, you know, just the multitude. It means just a mixed bag of people. But it would be people from all walks of life, rich and poor, everybody in between, so on. So that's something that's important. And then he follows up on that. You go back to Matthew chapter 11. And he says something that he says a lot. He says, I'm ahead of myself. In verse 6, he says, "Blessed is he who is not offended by me." The thing he says lots later on. This is the idea of being blessed if you do not stumble. You know, the word offense means something quite different today than it did then. Even in the English language, it meant something different in, you know, 300 or 400 years ago than it does today. We find a number of things today that are said to be offensive. As a matter of fact, it seems like right now the greatest and most harmful thing that anybody can do is to say or do something that offends someone else. I remember seeing a little thing, a little picture, as almost like a poster on Facebook, and it said, 2015, the year everybody was offended. And I thought, yeah, that's about right. I mean, it's just like wildfire with people. But the word offense to us means that somebody does something or says something that I don't like. And you need to stop it. People are being forced to stop, whatever it is. If you don't like something, well, you have to stop. Doesn't matter if what you said was right or not. You just have to stop. I thought to myself, well, you know, I guess it's kind of like if you were to, something that offends me. Well, I have never run into this, but if someone were to be playing the accordion too loud on New Year's Eve, that would pretty well offend me. I don't know about anybody else. And they'd have to stop doing that. That's the idea. And it's almost just kind of hard to take. But now, the original word, and in the New Testament, it meant something different. It meant that it was to be an obstacle. Now, a real bona fide obstacle. And it was an occasion of stumbling. Sometimes the same word that's used as an offense is used other places and translated in English as stumbling block. Well, we know what that is. It's something that does what? Well, it trips you up. And if you're tripped up, you know what the next thing is. You're tripped up, right? I doubt I'm the only person who's ever been walking along someplace and been tripped up. Well, to be tripped up's one thing. Yeah, sure, that happens. And then if you don't catch yourself, you know what happens? You fall after you're tripped up. So, the idea of something that's an offense is something that can lead someone to fall. You lose your faith over this. This is something that's serious, not somebody just playing some musical instrument too loud or saying or doing something or perhaps wearing some kind of clothing that I don't necessarily like. It means more than that. And when you think about it and you follow up with the word and look for it, now, depending on your translation, you'll find the word offended or stumbling or I think the Numeric Standard Version has a lot of times just plain fall away. But this is mentioned a number of times in the New Testament. I'm not going to read all these. You know what they are. There were superficial disciples, the parable of the sower when it's explained, and the seed that fell on the rocky soil, and it didn't penetrate very deep. It was superficial. And they followed along for a while, and boy, they were really into it. They were really happy. Then what happened? Well, something happened, and they're out of there. Superficial followers. Yeah, and they were offended. They fall away. The friends and neighbors of Jesus in his hometown, they thought he'd lost his mind. Even some of his family members
it seemed like we're leaning in that direction. They were offended. There were the religious leaders. You find in Matthew chapter 15, verse 12, the disciples came and reported to him, "Oh, Master, did you know that the Pharisees are offended by you?" If that happened today, Jesus would just have to clam up and be quiet, you know. He knew that. And they were the ones that had the problem, not him. But then here's something interesting. Even his disciples, the 11 minus Judas, you know, it says that even they were offended. They forsook him, didn't they? When he was arrested, remember? Jesus said they're going to strike the shepherd and the sheep will scatter. The sheep will be offended by me. And you remember what Peter said? All the rest of these, they might be offended by you, Lord. Not me. Well, it didn't quite work out that way, did it? So we can understand how that works and what it means, really means. And I thought to myself, you know, when I was doing this, I thought, well, now today, folks are offended by Jesus because he does not agree with them. Now, consider that. They're offended by Jesus because he does not agree with them. I have always thought that you and I and everyone else, we need to discipline ourselves to agree with Jesus and what he said and to do the things that he says to do. But that's not so with a lot of folks. A lot of folks think, well, here's Jesus saying something, and if I don't like that, if I don't agree with that, well, get that out of here. But Jesus has to agree with me. Well, this is what Jesus said on the subject. I remember being in the Waffle House in Sharonville, Ohio, a bunch of preachers together in there, and the waitress, she heard our conversation, and we had Bibles on the table there, had a little study going on, and she started asking questions, and we got into this, that, and the other. And you know, I thought, well, kind of typical, because she headed straight for the fact of being divorced and living with some guy she's not married to, and what does the Lord say about that? And there was one or two that, you know, chimed in with that, and the rest of us, you know, were... Do you all see it that way? Yeah, we see it that way. We see it that way because that's what the Scriptures say, you know. She said, well, I just don't see it that way. I just think God sees it differently. Now, where's that come from? What's she going to do to back that up? Well, that's what she wants. I want it to agree with me. I don't want to say, and that's what Jesus better do. Now that, I mean, some people are that brazen that they just expect that. And if he doesn't agree, well, Jesus is just wrong. He doesn't agree with me. They'll say, well, he's too narrow-minded. I think he did say something one time about a narrow way, and it led to life, and few there be that find it. I got an idea that doesn't agree with a whole lot of folks. They'd be offended by that when they see it or hear it. He's not politically correct. Well, no, he wasn't politically correct. Well, neither were his apostles either. I don't think they were too concerned about that, but I don't think it was deliberate. I don't think political correctness existed then, whether you think it's right or wrong. He's too harsh. Imagine. The person who was beyond all others who ever lived before or after with love and compassion for so many in whatever condition they were in. Someone who was willing to lay down his life for sinners and ungodly people is too harsh. He doesn't offer universal salvation. I mentioned that this morning. People are shocked to find out that Jesus said, not everyone who says, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven. That just doesn't agree with my concept. Get that out of here. That's right. That's what being offended by Jesus would mean. And we see it back then and we see it now. Jesus said, blessed is the one who's not offended because of me.
When you get to verses 7 through 14, I like to think of this as the legacy of John. A legacy reflects the life that was lived. I don't think there's anything more foolish than someone who tries to direct their own legacy. Or perhaps, you know, pick the epitaph for their tombstone. Or something along that line. And I've told John a time or two, I wonder what it would be. You know, you ever think about it? Probably what other people might put on our tombstone might be different than what we put on there ourselves, wouldn't it? Might be real different. But you know, everybody's got a legacy. It doesn't matter. It could be a good one or a bad one, but everybody's got a legacy. We all lived a life. And it all says the story of who we were. That's what a legacy is. It's true that John did not meet the expectations of many. He didn't. He was a man who was, I tried to find a better word, but I couldn't, earthy and plain. He was a man that lived out by himself, out in a wilderness where nobody else lived. He was dressed plainly, roughly, the camel's hair coat, the leather belt. And he ate honey, locusts, which actually locusts were not as horrible as it sounds. They were kind of a delicacy. But he was just different from people that might live in town. We get the picture, don't we? And he wasn't going to be somebody that somebody might invite to their daughter's coming out party. But he also was a man, it says right here, Jesus calls him a prophet. You can read those passages, Isaiah chapter 40, verse 3, Malachi chapter 3, verse 1. And while being a prophet and compared to Old Testament prophets, the other prophets, you know, the Old Testament prophets foresaw Jesus. They foresaw him. But John actually beheld Jesus, didn't he? Yeah, he did. He was the greatest of prophets due to his work. And the announcement and the nature and the coming of the kingdom, you know, he goes on, Jesus does, to point out that it's going to have various measures of opposition, you know, violence and other things, and it's going to be difficult. But John was sent into this. And in Malachi chapter 4 and verse 5, "Behold, I'm going to send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and terrible day of the Lord." That's Malachi chapter 4, verse 5. Luke chapter 1, verse 17, is actually where it says that John would come in the spirit and power of Elijah. He wasn't Elijah reborn or raised from the dead or something like that. But he was someone like Elijah. And you know what's always kind of fascinated me by this? Malachi chapter 4, verse 5. Is right at the end of the Old Testament, right at the very end of last chapter, one of the last verses. And it's speaking of the Elijah who was to come, which we find out is John the Baptist. Then when you go over into the New Testament, and when you get into the action of the New Testament, I know it's got the genealogies and other things like that, but when you get into the action of the New Testament, who's first? It's by John the Baptist. Isn't that something? So in a sense, even though there's so many years in between, they almost pass seamlessly here. And the person that connects it is actually John and the work that he did. And so, yes, it's quite the legacy. And, you know, you read the things in there and, you know, it's almost like, you know, when you went out there, what did you expect to see? What were your expectations? Well, they had other expectations. Well, he didn't meet their expectations. And Jesus freely admits that because, you know, he was a man here with a job to do. And he did it. And he's commending him for that. And there's been no other prophet like him. Verse 15, this was the one I mentioned a moment ago that Jesus often uses. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. You know, in colloquial language of today, that means listen up. That's what it means. And it's used a number of times by Jesus. And I think the idea is listen up, you know, because there's choices that you need to make. You acknowledge John. and you acknowledge what he was doing, the forerunner. If you acknowledge that, you acknowledge the one who's coming after this. You know, you make a choice on things. How about this, when we think about what choice do we make in 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 4, it says about those that will turn their ears away from the truth and be turned aside to fables. Well, your choice is the truth or fables, something that's not the truth. And everybody's going to make a choice on this. So now listen up. We'll make the case, and you make a choice. That's how it works. In verses 16 through 19, it's kind of interesting. It's a lot easier than what people make it out to be. It's really a very poignant lesson about fickleness. It starts off with him saying, "But to what shall I liken this generation?" Now think about that for a minute. This generation. He's saying there, I mean you. I'm not talking about your ancestors. I'm not talking about the people that are going to come. What am I going to liken this generation? You. You that are hearing what I'm saying. What are they like? I think this kind of goes back to that offending business just a little bit. But now, I don't know how else to put this. In the marketplace was an open area and the shops were around. This is how they were about all built. On a colonnade, sidewalks around, and the shops were behind that. And the open area, that's where the children would go while their parents were in the shops. The children would go out there, and that's where they'd play their games. And they were like children are today. They play copycat games. You know what a copycat game is, you know. The children see the adults doing things, and then they copy that. It's like my daughter and son, she was 7, he was 2, her 2 cousins about Jenny's age, and they would be playing church after services, and you could watch them. Daniel would be sitting here in the pew. Cousin Amy, she was the song leader. She had a song book, and she'd stand up there, and you could tell what she was doing. And then her sister Amy, she was up there, and boy, she had her head bowed. She looked really serious. There's the Lord's Supper. She was in charge of the table. And then Jenny would get up there with the Bible. Well, I figured this one out. And boy, I mean, she was the preacher, and she was giving Daniel a lot of this right here while she was preaching. And he'd eventually get up and wander off. And I would ask her one time, I said, I get what everybody's doing. You know, you got a song leader, you got the Lord's Supper, and you got the preaching. I said, what's Daniel's part? Well, Dad, he's the sinner. I guess he got tired of being the sinner and kind of wandered off, you know. But kids play copycat games, and they've done it for decades, centuries. That's what they were doing back here. Now, here's what was going on. When he says, we played the flute for you and you did not dance, well, they were playing their copycat games, and let's play wedding. That's what they were doing there. That's what it meant. About all commentators agree that's what it meant. And yet, there were some, and you know how it is with kids, there are some, I'm not going to play that. We're not going to do it. They're not going to do it. All right. So, well, okay, we'll change. Let's, we mourn to you. The New American Standard has, we sang a dirge to you. Oh, you don't like the wedding game? Okay, let's play funeral. Let's go all the way the other way. And we'll play funeral. And so they would go through that, and perhaps the same ones, they're over there. I'm not going to do that either. That's how kids are. That's right. And sometimes you just can't, they just refuse, and they can't be satisfied. You know, it's that old thing about, well, I'll just take my ball and go home. Yeah, that's kids, isn't it? Adults are nothing like that, are they? Hmm? They're nothing like that. Hmm? Oh, yeah, they are. Has anybody in the history of the church at North Ridgeville ever decided, I'm not going along with this. I'm going to take my ball and go home. Ever happen? Or perhaps decide to go somewhere else where, after a little while, they're not happy there, and they take their ball and go. Has that ever happened here?
it's happened every place I've ever been and every place I've ever heard of. And those were adults playing that game. I wonder if the Lord's pleased with that. Children might get a pass. But how about adults? And he goes on to address the adults because John, like this now, came neither eating or drinking, and they say he has a demon. Now it says, by my research, that idea of he has a demon meant that, you know, he's out of his mind. He's crazy. A lunatic. And so he didn't satisfy them. We can't accept him because, well, he didn't come eating or drinking. And then along comes Jesus, and he comes along eating and drinking, and didn't like that either. Sound like those kids in the marketplace. John didn't satisfy him. Jesus doesn't satisfy him. And away we go. He just couldn't do it. One would say, oh, well, too strict. Another says, well, he's too lenient. And do they even know what they want? This is the thing. Sometimes the folks who decide, I'm not going to go along with this. I don't like it. I don't like decisions that are made. I don't like what's being taught. I don't like the preaching. I don't like the song leading. I don't like this. I just don't like. And then if you were to walk up to him and say, just exactly what do you want? I don't have any idea. I find that curious too. I think maybe a psychiatrist would have an answer for it, but I never have been able to figure one out. But at the end of this, when it says wisdom is justified by our children, both John and Jesus performed as they were sent by the wisdom of God. What they taught and did is all the justification or vindication necessary. And I think that's what that particular thing means. Now, by way of conclusion, take your songbooks, turn to Songs Been Selected. John paved the way for Jesus. Behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. What do we do with Jesus? We make a choice. If we choose to follow Him, then we become a child of God. And once we become a child of God, we continue to follow Him. And whatever He says, we work to our best to agree with Him and to follow the things that He says to do. That's the mark of maturity. That's what Jesus expects. That's what God sent Him for. That's what John was paving the way to do. If we can help you to do these things tonight, we'd be glad to do so. If you're subject to the gospel invitation, please come all together. We stand and sing.